Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. My name is Karen Edwards, and I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. We're going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine, under the section of Healthy You. Straight to work. It's time to rethink your office layout. If you have been working from home lately, you've probably developed some spine-straining pandemic posture habits. Long conference calls at the kitchen table or using your recliner as a workstation can lead to pain, stiffness, and eventually injury. As many of us begin to head back to the office, it's a great time to reassess your workspace. Move your monitor. The top edge of your screen should be directly in line with your eyesight, says Susan Kotowski, associate professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. If it's too low, you'll hunch over, creating neck pain. If you use dual monitors, put the most used monitor directly in front of you. Upgrade your lighting. Aging eyes need more light than younger eyes. Kotowski recommends task lighting, an individual light that you can aim on a specific spot, such as reading or desk lamps. Set the right desk height. With your chair at your work surface, you should be able to comfortably maintain those 90-degree angles. If your desk is too high, add an ergonomic step stool under your desk to rest your feet on it. If it's too low, use furniture risers to raise the desk. Adjust your chair. Your office chair likely has height adjustability, rollers, armrests, and back support. When you're back at work, do this. Sit with your back fully against the back of the chair. Adjust the seat height so your feet are flat on the ground. Your knees, feet, and ankles should come to a 90-degree angle. Move the armrests so that your elbows form a 90-degree angle at your desk. If you're going to be telecommuting for a while more, consider investing in a work chair that allows for a similar position. Clamp your keyboard. Invest in a keyboard tray which clamps onto the desk edge and holds your keyboard at a more ergonomically friendly level. Typing at desk height can cause undue stress on the neck and lower back. And finally, get up, stand up. You've heard about how bad sitting is for health. So is a stand-up desk better? Yes and no. In one study, half of participants developed low back pain after standing at an ergonomic desk for 2 straight hours. The better strategy is to move positions every 30 minutes or so, alternating standing and sitting. Now we're going to move on to AARP The Bulletin, under the heading of Your Money, How to Buy an Index Fund. Cut through the clutter to find what's right for you. It's a classic example of a simple thing gone crazy. In recent years, countless financial experts have advised Americans to consider index funds, baskets of stocks or bonds that track the companies or investments that comprise market indexes, as a straightforward, low-cost, lower-risk way to invest without having to depend on a fund manager's luck or skill in picking winners. So what happened? A massive proliferation of index funds. Consider that there are 2,400 companies trading on the New York Stock Exchange and 2,500 U.S. index funds at latest count, according to the investment research firm Morningstar. Some 60 funds tracking the popular S&P 500 stock index alone. And although funds once focused on major indexes, such as those meant to represent all U.S. stocks, or all non-U.S. stocks, hundreds of funds are now tracking narrow and sometimes obscure sections of the market, like natural gas distributors or water industry companies. Indexing has gone from evolution to pollution, says Rick Ferry, an investment advisor at Texas-based Ferry Investment Solutions. Now, everything has become an index. Compounding the confusion, traditional index funds are passive, meaning that they don't require the active daily management by a professional stock picker. Passive may sound weak, but it isn't. Index funds have typically beaten the investment performance of most professional money managers while generally charging lower prices. But now pros burn the lines by devising indexes that then launching funds that track the indexes they have helped create. They are dressing active strategies in index fund clothing. Given so many options and so little clarity, how do you pick the right fund or funds? Look for breadth. Lower your investment risk by buying funds that represent broad slices of the market, not narrow ones. An S&P 500 index fund, for example, contains stock shares of 500 of the largest publicly traded companies in the U.S. Other stock indexes cast even wider nets. You can buy a total U.S. stock market index fund, which gives you exposure to companies both big and small in a variety of industries, or even a total world stock market fund. The narrower the index, the greater your risk. A fund that tracks only one industry or corner of the world can get walloped by a tiny bit of bad news that leaves the broader market unscathed. Minimize your fees. Two funds tracking the same index can charge you far different amounts, costing you thousands of dollars over time. Get the one with the lowest cost, says Stephen Craffin, a senior planner at Atlas Fiduciary Financial in Oakland, New Jersey. Specifically, look for no-load funds which don't charge a percentage of your upfront investment. Then, select one that has a low expense ratio, which includes management fees and other costs of running the fund. You can readily find it on a fund's website or on any site with fund quotes. The fine print matters. Last fall, for example, one S&P 500 index fund had an expense ratio of 0.02%, while another fund tracking the same index charged a much higher 1.65%. Imagine that you put $10,000 into each fund and the S&P returns 7% annually. 20 years from now, you would have $38,550 in the inexpensive fund, but only $28,360 in the expensive one, a shortfall of more than $10,000. Be tax smart. Funds based on a particular index are often sold in two different forms, each with the same lineup of shares, a mutual fund and an exchange-traded fund, ETF. If you're buying inside a tax-sheltered account, like a 401k or an IRA, either is okay. But if you're using a regular taxable account, buy the ETF, Craffin advises. Why? A mutual fund could expose you to capital gains taxes every year, even if you don't sell any shares. But because ETFs and mutual funds are constructed differently, ETFs typically avoid capital gains until you sell. Put it all together. You can build a diversified portfolio, Ferry says, by buying three simple funds, a total U.S. stock market fund, a total U.S. bond fund, and a broad-based international fund. You can make this even simpler by buying a single balanced fund or target date retirement fund that has underlying investments in both stock and bond index funds. Balanced funds typically allocate a fixed portion to stocks and bonds. The exact proportion in target date funds depend on your age and risk tolerance. But as people near retirement, they tend to increase bond exposure to protect from stock market declines. Moving on to the Centennial Living Complete Guide to Heart Health for folks over 50. Gone too soon. Losing a dear friend made this writer question her own health. I turned 54 last year, in early November. Given 2020, it was a fairly unremarkable birthday. Maybe a glass of wine and a video chat with friends. I didn't give it much thought, except I did notice that a longtime friend of mine, Kat, who was living in L.A., didn't call or text like she always did on my birthday. When I talked to a mutual friend of ours that week, I mentioned it. We figured that she was just busy, so we each sent emails and texts checking in, but got no answer. After a couple of weeks of prompts to please get in touch, we were officially worried. I tracked down her work email and started reaching out to people on her social media pages to see if anyone had heard from her. Finally, just after Thanksgiving, I located the place where she had been living and was told she was no longer there. Next, I finally reached someone at her office and explained my concern about my friend. Expecting to hear that she had quit, instead the woman quietly said, "She died." Like a gut punch, it took the wind out of me and I shook my head in disbelief. The woman gave me her sister's contact information and then, realizing she'd probably told me too much already, said she couldn't tell me anything else. Still in shock, I connected with her sister that evening and found out Kat had died on Halloween. She had always loved that holiday and would always dress up in an outrageous and highly detailed costume. Madonna, Elvis, Wonder Woman. After feeling sick for several days, her boyfriend had been away for a few days, and when he came back, he said she looked like she'd aged 20 years. Despite his urging, she wouldn't go to the doctor. She didn't want to deal with the coronavirus testing. It was near peak COVID craziness in L.A. at that point. "I know my body," she had told him. Digging through her papers, her sister discovered a lab report showing Kat's cholesterol was in the 300s back at her last doctor's appointment, which had been in 2012. Best we could tell. The conclusion from the coroner, atherosclerosis, at least one artery was severely blocked. She was a vibrant, fun, smart, quirky, sensitive, creative woman, and she was only 55. The big picture. The weird thing, in the weeks before we knew what had happened to Kat, our mutual friend had sent us one of those group emails listing the warning signs of heart attacks in women. Kat was already dead when it hit her inbox. "I still can't believe she's gone, and I'm so frustrated that she didn't go to the doctor, that she hadn't been under the care of a doctor in general, from what we know. How could she die at 55? Turns out, about 20% of people who die of heart disease are younger than 65. Kat had ultra-high cholesterol, and heart disease runs rampant in her family. Her diet, ever since I'd met her back in the 80s, had always been light on whole food and heavy on processed fare. Formerly slim, she had put on a lot of weight over the last decade. She had also been under a tremendous amount of stress. Until the last year or so, she had been unemployed or underemployed for the better part of that decade and living in a series of sketchy apartments and roommate situations. Typical L.A. She had lost her mother in 2019 to heart disease-related complications, and she had been estranged from most of her family since then. Scared straight. Understandably, I think, the whole situation freaked me out and made me question my own health. I've had borderline high cholesterol for as long as I can remember, but my HDL levels are always good enough to keep my overall ratio of total to HDL cholesterol in the safe zone. It should be between 3.5 and 5. Mine is 4. My LDL is on the high side, and my triglycerides are fine. Since my blood pressure runs low, and since I don't smoke or have diabetes, my 10-year cardiac risk score, the odds of having a cardiac event in the next 10 years, is low, just 1.5%, according to my primary care doctor. My mother, who's 80, has never had a heart attack that we know of, but she has pretty much all the other heart issues, including heart failure, atrial fibrillation, dilated cardiomyopathy, ventricular tachycardia, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure. If it wasn't for her pacemaker and defibrillator and a bunch of medications, she would be dead. She also has dementia. Her mother died at 62 in her sleep. We chalked it up to a broken heart since my grandfather had died not long before that, also of a heart attack, I just discovered. But when I recently dug up her death certificate, it said ventricular tachycardia. My father, an avid smoker, survived two tours of Vietnam and died at 58 of complications from multiple sclerosis, with no known heart issues. His mother died at 94 with a cholesterol level in the 300s. So should I be worried? I asked my mother's doctor what he thought. Family history is very, very important, he explains. We have these algorithms, the 10-year risk scores, where we look at these different factors. But the one factor that isn't included is family history. So the general rule is we take the score we get and we double it if you have a family history. That puts me at 2.5% risk. I spoke with my doctor about my concerns, panic, and asked if I should be on a statin. He still didn't think it was necessary given my low 10-year risk, but he suggested I get a coronary artery calcium scan to put my mind at ease. This simple test uses X-rays and computerized tomography, CT, technology, to look at the arteries in my heart to see how much calcified plaque has built up. Confession. I'm a healthcare practitioner and health journalist, and I'm ashamed to admit there was a bigger part of me that preferred the ignorance is bliss approach over knowing exactly how clogged my arteries are. But I got the test, which is quick, inexpensive, and non-invasive. And I've never been happier to receive a zero score on a test, which means my risk of coronary artery disease is very low. I scored a zero on my coronary artery scan, I proudly told my doctor. It can be a useful way of determining if you should go on medication, along with other risk factors, he assured me. But you need to check it again in 5 years, especially since I'm still relatively young by heart disease risk standards. And here was the kicker. It only looks for plaque that has calcified, he said. That means my arteries could still be lined with plaque that the machine can't see yet. Gulp. Testing 1, 2, 3. Since I was due for my annual blood work anyway, I had my doctor check my cholesterol, blood sugars, and C-reactive protein, CRP, a marker for inflammation. The result? My cholesterol is unchanged from last year. CRP is within the normal range, and my blood sugars are fine. I've also made some lifestyle changes mentioned throughout this issue, including upping my physical activity every day. I do HIIT workouts about 3 times a week, in addition to daily walks and regular yoga. Trying to lose a little weight, I'd like to drop 10 pounds. Eating a more plant-based diet, I try to go meatless half the time, and trying to cut back on sugar, hard. And what about all those other heart issues which tend to run in my family? Research has shown statins may help protect against some of these, but there's no great way to test for or predict whether I'll have the same issues. Unfortunately, says my doctor, I just have to pay attention to any symptoms such as dizziness, shortness of breath, or decreased stamina, and check in with my doctor regularly. Oh, and stick with my heart-healthy changes for life. I wish Kat had done that. Maybe we'd be planning a post-COVID girls' trip now instead of a memorial service. Was she afraid of going to the doctor and finding out it was something serious? We'll never know. But at least I now have more insight to guide my decisions. Just like any relationship, you may think you know your body, but you also have to listen to what it's telling you. So now I think we could use a little more of prevention, finding your calm. This is from 13 Positive Affirmations for When Life Starts Becoming Too Much. Repeating these simple mantras can help you shift your outlook. So we are on, let's see, number 9. Do the best now. Living in such a goal-oriented society, it can be difficult to pay attention to the now. since we are often looking ahead. If you know that something is the best possible thing to do, then there's really is no reason to put it off, explains David Bennett, certified counselor and co-author of several health self-help books. It's easy to put off our best for a future time, like, for example, saying, I'll be generous when I get a raise, or I'll be happy when the workday is over. Instead, I remind myself to do the best now. Breathe in calm. Exhale stress and tension. Focused breath can be a powerful tool, which is what this mantra is all about. This mantra works for me because I remind myself that by expanding through my breath, I allow calm to come into my mind and release the stress, explains Tracy Strucker, who regularly posts a mantra for the day in her Instagram. Attaching the affirmation to a physical behavior helps to anchor it. When I take a deep breath, my unconscious remembers the mantra and releases stress on the exhale. And that again was breathe in calm, exhale stress and tension. Number 11, I'm capable of handling anything that comes my way. Self-doubt can be an intense trigger for stress and anxiety, so it's important to remind yourself that you are capable. Growing up, I always felt I was not enough in one way and too much in another, says writer and life coach Diana Fletcher. I remind myself that I love myself and I only hurt myself when I get angry or resentful. I need these reminders all the time, so I say them aloud when I'm alone, in my head other times, and even write them over and over sometimes. We have two more to go. We'll save those for next time. Now, how about some Q&A from Mel Brooks? This is from AARP, The Bulletin. Comedy comes from what we know about living and dying. At 95, the renowned Brooklyn-born comedian and author of the new book, All About Me, is still cracking us up. Question, when did you first realize you were funny? When I do my stand-up act, I say, I knew I was funny when people would peer into my crib and break out in laughter. I knew right then and there that that's what I had to do for a living, just show my funny face. I had the happiest childhood ever in Brooklyn, but it all came to a close when I was 9 and they asked me to do something called homework. I realized then that life wasn't going to be a free ride. They wanted something back. Why did you change your name to Brooks? I changed my name because I was a drummer at age 14, and I didn't think that Melvin Kaminsky, or Kaminsky, would look as good as Mel Brookman on a bass drum. Brookman was my mother's maiden name. I started painting Mel and Brook on the drum, but there wasn't room for the man, so I threw in an S instead. Then I got a little notoriety as a drummer, and that name, Mel Brooks, stuck. What did drumming teach you about comedy? There is a thing in drumming called the rim shot, where the stick hits the edge and the middle of the snare drum at the same time. It's a great sound. It's like the punchline of a joke. Drumming is about rhythm, and comedy is about rhythm, too. What did you learn working with Sid Caesar? He would do impressions, but not of James Cagney or Edward G. Robinson. He would do real people, like the guy who works at the garment center or the bus driver. And they were brilliant. He was an enormous talent. So I hitched my wagon to his star. What was the creative environment like at Sid's shows? We would curse at each other all the time. The writer's room was like a battleground, but in the end we realized that a good, funny idea is like a high tide. It raises all boats. Tell me about Carl Reiner, your partner in the 2,000-year-old man records. He enjoyed trapping me like a mouse in a corner, and then he would be amazed when I would come flying out with a joke. Sometimes, if I hit him unexpectedly, he would literally fall down on the floor. We had the most fun doing the act at parties. Once he asked me, "You've had many wives. Who was your favorite?" "Shirley," I replied. "Why Shirley?" "Because every time Shirley came to the house, she brought her friend Lila." And Carl hit the ground. Making him laugh out of control was the thrill of a lifetime. falling down laughing? You must be exaggerating. Oh, no. I was a purveyor of a different kind of comedy. Comedy that was unexpected, true, human, and busted people up. How would you define it? It's people comedy. It's not made up. It comes from everyday life and what we all know about living and dying. I left the Henny Youngman School of Comedy very early in life. You know, my wife said, "You never take me anywhere anymore." So I took her to the kitchen. Jokes don't make it. It has to come out of human endeavor, and then it works. In your book, you talk about how all your movies are about the conflict between love and money. How so? Is it greed or is it love? Do the characters go after the gold or after the relationship? What happened with my first movie, The Producers, which is based on the idea that you can make more money on Broadway with a flop? Did that come from your family experience? No, it came out of opening my eyes to what society was all about. Society is about success and failure. To achieve success, you might want to give up some sweet, wonderful human qualities. But that's a high price to pay if you lose the love of those around you. I realized that that's a basic problem for all of humanity, not just for me. You also make the point that funny movies have to have a serious underlying theme. It can't be just silly comedy with pies in the face. Something has to drive it. Blazing Saddles, for instance, seemed to be a frivolous, crazy movie, but the engine behind it was racial prejudice, the idea that we've got to realize all people deserve respect. Finally, when you started as a comedy writer, you got so nervous that you sometimes vomited in the studio parking lot. How did you get over that? Mel Tolkien, our head writer on your show of shows, sent me to see his psychoanalyst. He helped me figure out the reason for the nervous throwing up. It all boiled down to not enough self-esteem. Once I gained enough confidence, I not only stopped throwing up, but I also demanded a raise. And I got it. We have a few more good comments from him, but we will save that till next time. Now, just another comment or two about how to save money. Shop beyond Amazon. This is from AARP The Bulletin. Amazon is so easy to use that it can become a pattern, but online services from Walmart, Target, and Costco sometimes offer better deals, and online-only retailers like eBay and, for electronics, Newegg are sometimes cheaper. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.